Hi, this is Ross Payton with Unspeakable. This is episode 3. We're here with Shane Ivey and Scott Glancy. So I am, of course, Ross Payton, here with the author of Zombies of the World and co-host of Role Playing Public Radio and author of Road Trip and Curriculum Conspiracy, books for monsters and other childish things. And, of course, then my co-host is Shane Ivey, editor of The Unspeakable Oath. And
blow your horn, Shane.
That's me. I edit The Unspeakable Oath. I run Arc Dream Publishing, and I'm involved in new Delta Green material and lots of other games and stuff that that Arc Dream does. And and we probably won't be talking much about it, but I'm back on a total Tolkien kick, like an addict who's taken his first hit in years. Thanks to the
Have you fallen off?
Oh God, that fucking wagon. Yeah, so it's all because of the One Ring game that I talked about in my blog update about Gen Con. It debuted at Gen Con, and we spent a lot of time hanging out with the author Francesco Nepitoli at the show, and now I'm just going through it and drooling over it, and having all kinds of campaign ideas sparking.
A friend of mine back in high school summed up Tolkien like this. You'd be reading the book, and you'd come to a passage that would say, "And then the party of the ring was set upon by a band of 300 orcs." Mm-hmm. After they killed the orcs, what? I mean, that was your fight sequence. Was after they killed the orcs, Aragorn saw a blade of grass that reminded him of a song, and you get 10 pages of song. And I'm presuming that your campaign ideas are coming from the songs.
Yeah, well, you know, it's fun because for me, running a game based on Tolkien, I kind of approach it the same as I do running a game based on Lovecraft, which is. There's lots of stuff that I love about Lovecraft and about Tolkien that I would love to explore in a game or a story in my own language and with my own approach. So
we might get to hear about the 300 orcs that set upon the party of the ring.
Yeah, exactly. But even in Tolkien, you know, I mean, even in the stuff as written, there were a lot of those scenes that. You know, that I really just got a kick out of, even as written, as dry as he could sometimes be, he also had these flashes of, you know, of really, really great, amazing detail, which is what kind of drew me into it, to begin with. So, that's not Lovecraft at all.
No, but. We're allowed a certain amount of latitude here, right? We can drift in and out of Lovecraft a little bit.
Yeah, if people don't want to hear about it, you can just shut the damn thing off.
Well, you know, whenever I think about, you know, people getting addicted to Tolkien and Lord of the Rings, I remember a quote that there's an age when a boy reads one of two books. One of these books leaves you with no grasp of reality and a deeply warped sense of fantasy in place of real life. And the other... and if he's oh, so the quotes about Ayn Rand.
You either read Ayn Rand or read Tolkien.
Right.
Leaves you deeply sense of fantasy in place of real life. The other is about hobbits and orcs.
Yeah.
Anytime you guys want to spend kicking the shit out of Ayn Rand on this show, I'm perfectly willing to burn up that airtime. You know. Sticking it to the objectivist out there. If you're listening, you follow a philosophy that says there's nothing wrong with the world if only people would be more selfish. Explain again how that's going to fix everything.
As we said at Gen Con, I'm not working on the Atlas Shrugged role-playing game. So we're here, naturally, with Adam Scott Glancy. Who runs Pagan Publishing and is our sort of raconteur about town from that side of the world.
And how many times have you won a best Walter at a Lebowski Fest?
Oh, Jesus. thanks, Ross. I'm looking at three trophies. sitting on there. Sadly, I now have more Walter awards than I have Origins awards, which is a little depressing. But
hold on though, because how many Origins awards did you get?
I guess I have. Technically, I only have two. Pig and Publishers won two other awards for stuff that I was not involved with. We got best novel out of Rules of Engagement when it came out, and we got best, I believe it was production and design for Hills Rise Wild when it came out. But the two things are, of course, you know, best role playing game supplement for Delta Green and Delta Green Countdown.
Well, of course, you now have two more not Origins, but two more big awards for Targets of Opportunity. So squish those together, then.
I'm particularly fond of our Best Adventure Award.
Right.
That just makes zero sense to me that we got a Best Adventure Award for Targets, because we don't have any we don't actually have any laid out scenarios in Targets, and yet it won Best Adventure. And I'm like, okay, that's what are you trying to tell the other guys who didn't get second place? I mean, the guy who got third place, it's like, yeah, your adventure, it's not as good as the adventure these guys didn't write. that just seems mean
and that probably was mine, since Road Trip was in the same category. So if only Pathfinder wasn't in there, I might have gotten second place. But
I made a point of talking about that when I went up to do the acceptance speech. Now Ross, help my brain out one way or the other. Was my second acceptance speech any better than my first one?
Well, sure. I mean, that you're hitting not your saying a whole lot.
If you'd won 10 or 12 more awards, you would have been.
Would have got some practice in there, but and to Arc Dream's credit, you had a much you had a better song than some of those other publishers did when they came up to get awards. I mean,
did you pick your song, or was it just randomly?
You're supposed to pick it yourself, and then if you don't, then they'll just make something up.
Yeah. Wow. So what did you pick? I'm hoping it's something terrible, cheesy 80s montage, like maybe Eye of the Tiger.
No, nothing that fun. No, it was actually a clip from the Primitive Radio God song that I excerpted the lyrics from in Targets, if I remember right.
Okay. So
it was the song Standing Outside a Broken Phone Booth, which was all over the airwaves in 1996 and 97 when Delta Green first appeared and made its big splash.
Gestated. Interesting. I know I actually submitted my podcast, Role Playing Public Radio, for the Innies, and part of the submission is you fill out the song, you know, you choose and you have to send them an MP3 of the song. So I chose, if we actually got nominated or won anything, the title song or the theme song from the movie The Room.
Oh, Ross, what is your...
Wow.
Yeah, I think that would have been appropriate. I mean, it actually, if you listen to the music without any context, it sounds like, you know, Final Fantasy music from the Super Nintendo era. I mean, it really is very kind of generic-y. It has nothing to do with the movie whatsoever. I mean, it's just really bizarre, but... anyways, it's not even that dramatic. It's like, you know, the music you would hear when you're buying items from a shopkeeper or something like that. And but anyway, so I think we should get on to news and announcements. We, of course, are sponsored. The Unspeakable is sponsored by several fine companies, including Miskatonic River Press. They have some new books out, The Legacy of Aris Lurko for Cthulhu Invictus. Is that the new campaign they've just come out with?
Yeah, it's a big full length 4-part adventure campaign set in ancient Rome for Call of Cthulhu. So it ties in with Chaosium's Cthulhu Invictus Rome setting.
I actually just remembered. I picked up Cthulhu Invictus at this year's Gen Con, and I actually just ran my first session of it. I ran one of the adventures from the Cthulhu Invictus Companion, which I bought because it shows the cover art is great. It's a dark young fighting lions in a gladiatorial arena that's on fire, you know. And of course, there's rich, evil, insane, decadent Romans drinking and watching. And it was very entertaining because the players actually managed to kill the dark young in the scenario because while firearms do very little damage to dark young, hand to hand weapons do normal damage. So Roman centurions are better equipped to fight Dark Young than investigators with shotguns and Tommy guns. So that, of course, there were some injuries and madness going on. So
yeah.
Our next sponsor is the H.P. Lovecraft Film Festival, September 16th and 17th in Los Angeles, and September 30th through October 1 in Portland. I don't know what kind of movies are they. I mean, obviously, what kind, but what do you know what movies are being shown?
Well, the Whisper and Darkness, of course, is their big key.
Ooh, yeah. Thing.
So, Scott, are you going to the Portland one this year?
Yes, I am. Pagan sells stuff through Psychographics, which is one of the sponsors of the festival. And although we're not going to have a booth or anything at the festival, I'm going to be showing up with Jared Wallace from Dagon Industries, and we'll be helping to run Psycho's booth for them. And we'll be attending, seeing whatever it is that they've got on the menu for us.
Yeah. Have you seen Whisper in Darkness yet yourself?
Absolutely not. It was it came through here as part of the Seattle International Film Festival, and I did not see it. Events conspired. And I figured, you know, I'll see it. I know this is not going to escape. I mean, I got a couple more good shots at it, and so seeing it at Seeing it at the film festival seems like the natural place. I got to see some of the previews for it at the last film festival. They ran some previews for it, and one of the sneaks they gave us was a look at the Mego that they've designed for the movie. And I got to tell you, they designed a Mego that was very, very much took advantage of sort of Willis O'Brien style stop motion. And Willis O'Brien is the guy who did, King Kong and The Lost World and that early stop motion. He's the Harryhausen before Harryhausen.
Right.
And it looked really good for a couple of reasons. Number one, it does look good. But number two, it really did a good job of sort of capturing that 1930s style stop motion monster thing.
What I thought was fascinating is if I remember right, they originally started off with wanting to make it entirely stop motion, and then they found that it would actually be more affordable for them to have it digitally animated to look like stop motion, and they were able to pull that off seamlessly.
Yeah, it comes off absolutely looking like stop motion.
So that's pretty cool.
So yeah, I'll definitely be lined up for that. Going to Los Angeles is a bit of a trip, and apparently I need to confirm this, but there's some rumor going around that there is going to be a H.P. Lovecraft Film Festival in Seattle, that they're going to be using the theater at the Museum of Science and Industry, and that S.T. Yoshi, the Lovecraft biographer and Lovecraft scholar who lives up here now, has something to do with this project. I haven't been able to track down all the right information about it yet, but it's supposed to be yet another Northwest. Apparently it's all West Coast love of Lovecraft out here. So there's supposed to be yet another film festival, although apparently they're going to, from what I can tell, concentrate on sort of there's gonna be some films, but there's gonna be a lot of authors and author panels and things like that.
Interesting.
To concentrate on rather than and that the one that's going on in Portland is gonna have none of that. Mm-hmm. They're not gonna have any of the author panels, they're not gonna have any of the discussion panels.
Right. This is purely the film festival.
So yes, they're just
towards the movies and film adaptations and so forth.
Exactly.
I've actually pulled up their website and I'm looking at it right now, and it seems that, you know, it's a two-night festival. They're gonna be showing classic gothic horror films and Lovecraft tradition on Friday night. This is for the LA one. I assume they're going to be similar. The Haunted Palace, Berkeley Square. Yeah. But then on Saturday night, they're going to have retrospective in the newest Lovecraftian movies from around the world. They're going to be starting with Cast a Deadly Spell.
Always a classic.
Yeah, and then there's a new film called The Forbidden Shadow, a Spanish film. Second part of the Valdemar legacy. This is an action piece with cameos by Lovecraft and one of his greatest creations, The Great Cthulhu. And then there's a bunch of shorts. And the winner with a contest, and Guillermo del Toro will be on hand for the LA one, and he'll be choosing the best of the shorts, and then The Whisper in the Darkness. So it sounds like there'll be quite a bit there.
I am sure poor Mr. Del Toro is going to be rent limb from limb by fans who want to know what happened to Mountains of Madness. The answer is, I don't know about you guys, but I've always doubted that there's going to be huge Hollywood interest in Lovecraft material, because too much of it is in the public domain, and if they can't own a property from top to bottom and make the toys and make the comic books or license the comic books, and you know,
yeah, well, they can. That's the thing. I mean, they can do all that, but they won't have an exclusive on it, and everybody else can take advantage of it too. So.
Exactly. Yeah. So, I've always felt that's going to make some of the big money shy away, because they cannot. They can't buy it the way they
right.
buy it.
Well, that never stopped Disney from, you know, taking over fairy tales.
Well, why do you think they're also rewritten from Disney? You know, if you rewrite them enough, then they're yours. They're not public domain anymore.
Yeah,
it's Walt Disney's Aladdin, and not the translation from 1001 Arabian Nights.
Yeah, sure.
Well, moving on, our other sponsors are Atlas Games, of course, our good friends who've got Clifford the Big Red God, which I got at Gen Con and is hysterical, and Cthulhu Gloom, which I also got at Gen Con and haven't had a chance to play yet, but it looks amazing.
Gloom looked pretty good. I've never played Gloom, but having had the game demonstrated to me, I was actually pretty impressed. It didn't look like something I would be interested in, but I really liked the mechanic of it, particularly that layers of card thing where you lay down. That really seemed to that had an appeal. I really liked that. It was an imaginative mechanic.
Yeah, well, it's fun because you're laying down the cards to show the effects and help tally up your points and whatnot. But there's also a lot of kind of stealing cards and moving them onto other people. So, you know, your goal in the classic Gloom, if I'm remembering right, is to kind of, you know, be the first to die, basically, or collect up the worst event, you know, for your side. And so you can kind of move cards around to screw yourself over harder than the other person got screwed over. And so it's a lot of fun. So with Cthulhu Gloom, I look forward to seeing, you know, that kind of action with, you know, insanity and elder gods.
Well, the idea that they just took the screw your neighbor mechanic and then, you know, turned it inside out. That's brilliant.
That's got some legs and tentacles on it.
Maybe some extra eyes.
Yeah. And then our last sponsor is, of course, Innsmouth Free Press at innsmouthfreepress.com. Fiction publisher. They have historical Lovecraft that is promoted on TheUnspeakableOath.com and in the magazine, and their website has lots of articles and interviews worth reading. Speaking of HPL Film Festival, they've got a big interview with Aaron Vanek, who's the organizer of it, up now. And
Aaron is I guess you guys haven't met Aaron. Aaron, I've known him from the festival for years, and he and the wife are huge LARPers, and you know, have this ridiculous collection of gigantic, you know, sort of 1920s gear that they've collected over the years. You hear these stories every once in a while from guys like Aaron Vanek or Andrew Lehman from the H.P. Lovecraft Historical Society about their idea of a LARP, you know, versus the average person's idea of a con LARP. Apparently, down in L.A., they think nothing of using an actual helicopter ride,
right?
As part of the LARP, just to get you into the mood.
I've never thought about that, but I guess in Los Angeles, where everybody is an actor, LARPing would take on a whole new dimension, wouldn't it?
Right.
Yeah.
Plus costume designers, prop builders, and stuntmen.
They're a little more serious than the rest of us, is all I'm going to say.
Wow, yeah. That's fun. I've never even thought about that. That
work hard, play hard.
The story that Lehman tells is that they had a game where it was sort of pre-Delta Green, where they all play FBI agents, and they were just told, you know, the people who participated in the LARP had to put up hundreds of dollars to be in the LARP.
Wow.
You put up money to be in the LARP, both as a player and as if you want to be a character, an NPC. And they had everyone meet out at the Los Angeles County airports, you know, and they were presented with their prop weapons, prop badge, prop handcuffs, you know, and they got the files on the case that were handed out by somebody at the airport, and then said, all right, we're taking you out to the site of the incident. And they ushered them through the airport to the rented helicopter.
That's so awesome.
And then got on the helicopter and flew out into the desert, where the night before, the day before, Lehman and his people had drawn an enormous sigil.
That's amazing.
In like a dry lake bed out in the desert, you know, and they then land and get, you know, first they fly over the sigil, which you can only sort of appreciate from the air, and then they land and the sigil and find the mummified body of the guy who disappeared in 1927 that has somehow been found in the middle of the sigil. Yeah. They definitely they go to 11. I'm just going to say their LARPs go to 11 and leave it at that.
Of course, they probably wouldn't, if they're doing that, they're still doing that today, they probably don't start at the airport with prop guns and prop bags.
Oh, no.
That's probably
this is way pre-9/11. No. You're right. You're absolutely right, Ross.
Whole new layers of verisimilitude you can explore. Yeah.
My immersion
guns at the modern airport. No, it's for a game.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that happened at the last Necronomicon. Robert McLaughlin was running all the LARPs there, and took a LARP out into some park that was near the hotel in Providence. You know, and the cops responded.
Nice.
As I understand, and McLaughlin had to explain that, you know, well, it's for a game, and that's why we have these guys dressed as Nazi zombies, you know, or whatever it was. I don't remember what exactly it was, but yes, they had to. I have this strange feeling that it was actually a World War II LARP, and Providence. The Providence police apparently bought it. I mean, nobody ended up getting bailed out, you know, so.
Well, good for them. Thank you very much, Providence PD.
Yeah. In other news, moving on.
Thank you very much to our sponsors, Miskatonic.
Yes, thank you.
HBO Film Festival, Atlas Games, Ismith Free Press. You guys rock. Okay, moving on.
We have to say goodbye and Godspeed to Torrin Atkinson because
he died. When did Torrin die?
Well, he
it was a horrible art accident.
He is working full time as an animator or concept artist for, I think it's Robot Studios, on some project. He is under a non-disclosure agreement, so we don't know exactly what he's doing. But
he's getting paid, and he has a Benny's package.
Yes, so he's sold out.
Which is a lot more than I could do for him.
Yeah,
dude, he didn't sell out. He bought in.
Slight difference.
So more power to him. I was thrilled to hear about that. The downside of that is he doesn't have anywhere near enough free time to keep staying on and contributing here. So you'll still see his art in the Oath, and in the magazine for the next several issues at the very least, and I hope beyond that. And of course we've still got his awesome music by him and his band, The Darkstead Hillside Thickets.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You'll still be hearing his voice. It's a sweet dulcimer voice beginning and end of each episode. So, and then, of course, in other news, this month we have H.P. Lovecraft's birthday. He turned 121 years old on August 20th, and he'd be or he would be if he, you know, if he
wasn't
passed
dead.
Away, yeah. But it's a good time, good day to remember him by reading another one of his stories.
Scott, do you want to sing Happy Birthday to H.P. Lovecraft for us?
No, we don't have the rights for that. Oh, God, no.
No, we don't have the rights to Happy Birthday. Holy crap. No.
Even like if you change it up, do like the sexy Marilyn Monroe version?
Wow, Shane, that's so
that's
not
a good way of summon that's a good way to cast the spell summon copyright lawyers.
Yeah. I don't have the binding element.
Except no one does, you know.
All I can think of is that Marilyn Monroe, I mean, just had that, you know, deflect copyright lawyer things field on. Who's really gonna give her a hard time for singing Happy Birthday to her boyfriend, the president?
Yeah, exactly.
Take a look at that film sometime. You look at the smile that's hammered onto JFK's face as he's sitting next to his wife.
Yeah.
He's just like, oh my God, I can't believe she's doing this. I thought she was discreet. The president does not look comfy at all.
Oh boy.
Yeah, I've only seen it. Actually, I'll have to dig up the whole thing. I've only seen it from, you know, the footage they show is of her singing it, not the president's reaction. I didn't.
Oh, there's a reaction shot, and he does not look at.
It's priceless.
adultery.
Exactly.
It was funnier then.
Yeah. Another news, we have the Innie Awards. As we mentioned earlier, Delta Green Targets of Opportunity took the silver medal for best writing, best adventure, even though there were no adventures in it.
There was writing, though.
Yeah, there was writing.
Ken Hyde's suggestion was that the shadow cast by a Delta Green book is better than 99% of the material of the adventures on the market, so clearly we deserved it.
Yeah.
Thank you, Ken.
Yeah. That's true. I mean, how many times can you crawl a dungeon?
A lot, apparently.
Yeah, apparently. And then, of course, Yogg Sothoth took the gold for their best podcast for Yogg Radio. Mm-hmm. And they were sort of one of the reasons why I even got into actual play podcasting is because they're doing Mass and I or Lothotep. Well, that sounds – well, they're doing it. Why can't I record my games? And so – They're an inspiration for us all. I keep meaning to order that DVD they have of, like, you know, gigs and gigs of their
Tales from the Table. Yeah, it's good stuff.
Yeah, I keep forgetting to. I should order that.
I'm gonna say it one more time. I love Paul McLean to death, but he plays Call of Cthulhu like a lemming on crack. He has no sense of self-preservation in that game. Listening to him play Masks, it's just, you know, there's a reason you're, Paul, there's a reason you're on character number 75. There's a reason. Just slow down. Slow down for just 5 seconds. Maybe you won't have to die every session.
Yeah.
Yep.
So did anybody besides me get the new 30th anniversary Call of Cthulhu hardback?
I looked at it, but that was pretty expensive.
Well, unfortunately, there's this whole thing, you know, with electricity and cable and phone that, you know, I need to do first. Mm-hmm. But yeah. Once all that's out of the way, yes, there's no reason why I'm going to take a crack at that as well.
I can't remember. Was it you? What was one of you? Someone was telling me you got a couple years ago. They released another sort of anniversary edition where they wrapped it in brown paper and made it look like it had been mailed from Miskatonic University.
That was Torin. Yeah. He said last episode that he got that, and because and the wrapping
was so nice
that he couldn't bear to actually open it up and use it.
So it's just on the shelf with the brown wrapping and the string around it. That's
presumably it has a Call of Cthulhu book underneath all that.
I trust Charlie. Charlie just didn't wrap up, you know, Glorantha and send it out. I'm sure
we've got 2,000 extras of this. They'll never know.
Exactly.
Just make it look nice.
And finally, so what is the status of the Unspeakable Oath issue number 21, Shane?
Issue 20 is still percolating out there. Our warehouse, God love them, they do enjoy taking their time in shipping things. So it's I dropped off. I delivered a bunch of had a bunch of issue 20 shipped to the warehouse before Gen Con, and then dropped off a bunch of extras that I had taken to the show afterward, and 19 as well. So those are still sort of floating out there and getting into people's hands. And then 21, has been kind of on hold as I finish everything with Through a Glass Darkly, the new Delta Green novel. And then we've got a short story that we're putting up for free for that as well, to thank all the people that supported it. So I'm getting through those over the next few days, and then I'll be diving into TUO 21. So I've got some good submissions for it. I've got some good scenarios that I really, really need to get people playtesting as quick as possible, and then I've got a lot of letters coming in from people saying,
I gotta tell you, Shane, this whole getting the quarterly journal out in a quarterly fashion really runs counter to everything that Pagan committed itself to make the cult classic that it is. I mean, it makes no sense. I don't understand how this is going to be a success, but
practically non-Euclidean.
You crazy kids, you go ahead with that whole accurate publishing schedule thing and see where it gets you.
Yeah, so it's exciting, but I don't know, it's a whole new thing I'm experimenting with.
I would say also for the people listening to RPPR, I know Caleb has submitted or is in some stage of submission for Lover in the Ice, the Delta Green scenario he wrote. I think he was also mentioning doing something with Bryson Springs. Mm-hmm. So if you had either, have you, I don't know what status that is. So those of you listening to the actual play, know what I'm talking about, but
yeah. They're great listens, but, I don't remember. I've exchanged email with him. I don't remember if I've gotten the full submissions from him or if it's just been exchanging notes back and forth. I look for, if I don't have them in hand already, I look forward to getting them and giving them the stink eye and sending notes back.
Yeah. And a related note, I know you mentioned this on Facebook, Scott, talking about scenario podcasting. I just got another email recently from another RPPR fan who wanted to know, when is. Yeah, I love Divine Fire, Tom Church's, World War II scenario for Call of Cthulhu, and he wanted to know if there were published notes of it. And I know you mentioned something that you're going to be at Penny Arcade, PAX.
Yeah, the Penny Arcade Expo, which is this really a huge computer gaming show here in Seattle, but many of the Seattle publishers have booths there. I believe Paizo and Green Ronin are going to make an appearance. I know for sure that Flying Frog is. Flying Frog are the guys who make Last Night on Earth and Touch of Evil.
These big, pretty board games. Yeah, and their pulp one they just did.
Their new, prettiest, pulpiest. Yes, it's got a Zeppelin on it. Of course, I'm going to have to buy it. It's got a Zeppelin and an eye patch on the cover.
How can you not? I mean,
it's fortune and glory. Hell, it even has a Zeppelin miniature in the game. There's a Nazi Zeppelin that tours the map spreading Nazis. So that their new game Fortune and Glory is going to be shown there. I would have bought it at Gen Con, except the box was so big there was no way I could get it into my luggage or into an overhead compartment, or it just couldn't get it home. It really is an enormous, enormous game. It was not the $100 price tag that set me back. It was the things the size of a steamer trunk.
It would be really fun if they made it in a little steamer trunk.
Oh, that my God. With covered with stickers that say, Borneo, Brunei.
The Plateau of Ling. Oh.
Exactly. So PAX is going to be – they contacted me at Gen Con and wanted me to run a workshop and a game. And the workshop's going to be a workshop on creating horror during role-playing. And, I'm supposed to give some sort of lecture on some other game mechanics and how the mechanics also how far the mechanics of horror can carry you versus, you know, how much you, the game master, the moderator, are just going to have to, if you don't bring the mood, you fail. There's only so far the mechanics can carry you in a horror game to create actual tension and horror. But building is a game, and I'm, you know, fishing around for something to run, and I've got a few con games that I could run, but I decided that I'm going to try and take Divine. I talked to Tom a while back about knitting Divine Fire into some material that somebody else had submitted, and I'm not going to get too specific about it, but there were elements of Divine Fire that were really right on the edge of being exactly this other material. And I'm going to try and take Divine Fire and knit it into modern Civil War Libya. So the players will be playing a team sent in to extract some Libyan nuclear scientists who are taking advantage of the chaos in Libya to get out with their families. And that's basically the kickoff for it. And we'll see how it plays out. We'll see. I'm going to try and record it, and I will see if, you know, how my take on it goes over, and certainly give Tom a chance to decide whether or not this is something, you know, he wants me to pursue working up as a modern piece. And frankly, in a lot of ways, it is sort of set up almost as a sequel. I mean, it could be, it wouldn't necessarily have to replace the original Divine Fire games. It could be just the next step in the process of this idea of the Divine Fire idea. So we'll see what happens. I'm a little nervous in that I agreed to allow up to 10 players. They have a giant conference room with a dry erase board and a big long conference table, and they said up to 10 players, and I'm like, okay, but you know, that just means everybody's wearing a red shirt. You know, there's not going to be anybody to demo the monster.
Do you have sort of like the stands on the other side of the room where the dead players can go and sit down and be audience?
You know, there's no bleachers. There's no corpse bleachers. Corpse bleaching. That doesn't sound right at all. But no, there's no corpse bleachers. But you know, it's a 6-hour block, and there's a very good chance that there are going to be people who are going to get torn apart like blood-soaked tissue paper early in the scenario, and then are going to be stuck being the witnesses. Their troubles will be over, and then they can mock the people who are pathetically trying to survive when clearly it didn't, you know, they didn't make it, so why should anyone else?
Yeah.
You know, that's one way it might work. I may blow out a few extra pre-gens just so that, you know, players can pick up another character after they, you know, fall out of the Zeppelin or whatever problem befalls them during the game.
Yeah.
We're going to try and do that. That's next Friday, or Friday coming up, the 26th. So if you're in the area, if you're in the Seattle area and you were attending PAX, which, oh my God, is sold out. Mm. They've been sold out of badges since late May.
That's
something
amazing.
Like that.
That's ridiculous.
Is it like 20,000?
Oh, God, it's no. Like, it's huge.
It's bigger than, there's more people than Gen Con. There's clearly more people than Gen Con.
Gen Con had 36,000 people this year.
Dude, it's bigger than Gen Con. It's in that range. It's in the 35,000 range is what it is.
Yeah.
And it is freaking massive. They pull in all the big stars like Felicia Day and Jonathan Colton, or at least they have in past years. Jonathan Colton has turned up and played at PAX a couple times. It's huge. I will admit that I think that the dealer area, not the dealer area, but the area that is set aside for the companies to demo their wares and show their stuff off, actually feels smaller than the Gen Con dealer's room. But it's not commerce. Mm-hmm. You know, 80 to 90% of what goes on there is just, you know, people setting up their, the, you know, guys, you know, setting up their latest game and letting you run demos of it, you know, so it's that sort of thing. Yeah, when I was there a while back, the guys who were, there was some, they, there was a booth set up for the guys who did, what was it, BioShock. You know, they were promoting one of the BioShock games, where the booth was just the interior of a private detective's office, filled with stuff. I mean, it was just things you could go in and pick up and look at, and pieces of paper, maps, you know, on the walls with pins in them, you know, bookshelves filled with books like The Case for the UFO, which is an actual 50s era, I think it's a 1950s era, a book on saucers or whatever. And there was no explanation for the booth. You just wandered into it and looked around, and it was, and I thought it was gutsy, but clearly too subtle for the average, you know, computer gamer. That's me, wild. At least.
Yeah.
It was this thing. What got the, you could pull the drawers open in the desk, and there was stuff in there too. Yeah, it was very cool. It was very nice.
That's crazy. Yeah.
But yeah, that we'll be running a version of Divine Fire and see how it goes over. I have high hopes, and in preparation, I have been listening to every version of Divine Fire that is currently on the RPPR site. I gotta love that Grunfeld.
Yeah.
Grunfeld's
very higher. Helpful NPC. He's very reasonable.
Yeah, well, let me just assure you that he's not going to be as reasonable this time.
I would imagine, yeah.
Don't broadcast this until after the game. Don't, no spoilers for the players.
Well, I think that will be even if they listen to that, that's not going to let them know what exactly how he's not going to be that helpful. I also want to say if you're doing the workshop, record that as well. We could put that on Unspeakable as well.
Okay, I'll see what I can do about that.
Yeah. So moving on, I guess we should start our little interview with you. And we're back, and we're talking to Adam Scott Glancy about his work with Pagan Publishing and Call of Cthulhu and Delta Green. So why don't we first talk with your background in Pagan Publishing?
How did that start? Yeah.
Yeah, that started because I was sick and tired of the job that I did have. When I was in law school, I got in touch with Pagan Publishing because there was this little game store in Gainesville, Florida, where I was going to law school, and they the first issues of the Unspeakable Oath were in there, the very first ones. And I saw these, you know, and saw that Blair Reynolds artwork, and was like, ooh. In fact, who's the fellow that works for you, Shane? John? What's John's
last? John Marin. Marin. He worked in, if I remember right, he worked in that game shop when you
yes. were going yes, there. Yes, he did. I just started reading those, and I thought, you know, and as time went on, I thought, well, I was spending some time, you know, entertaining myself by trying to write stuff during that period. I've told the story before, but we'll be fairly quick about it. But I eventually got around to submitting some stuff to Pagan, to John, and John's like, well, this is awesome, except we've kind of got something similar coming along. In the next issue of the Oath, and the next issue of the Oath was number 7 that had Convergence in it and Delta Green. And I was like, poop. Well, all right. You know, it's not like, you know, it showed up on shelves weeks later. So it's not like they, you know, I could do the standard fanboy thing. Go, oh, they stole my idea. You know, they stole my idea with the use of a time travel device and you know, but I thought, okay, well, you know, what can I do to help Delta Green go? I mean, you know, clearly you got this good idea. How can I help? And I started off by doing the agency templates in the back of the book, because I just had all this information I'd gathered from a job search, because I wanted to work in government. So I was looking for anything that a law degree would fit into. And vomited that out to John pretty quickly. And he was kind of flabbergasted that I, you know, had all this information at my fingertips, and said, okay, great, write some more stuff. And just started throwing out job assignments to me. And then, you know, I got to go to my first Gen Con when Delta Green came out, and they moved about a billion of them that year. And, you know, it won an Orange Award, and I just kind of got thrown into the deep end of the pool there, where I went my first Gen Con, I'm winning an Origins Award. So clearly it's all going to be downhill from here. You know, I got people I've only ever heard of coming up and going, I read Delta Green, it's really good. And I'm like, oh my God, that was Steve Jackson. Yeah. He's so short, you know. These people whose games I've been playing since, you know, I've been playing Steve Jackson stuff since Ogre turned up as a micro game from I think it was metagaming or whatever it is, where you'd, you know, you had your fold out piece of map in a Ziploc baggie and counters you had to cut out with a pair of scissors, you know. So it was a little stunning to run into people like that and go, wow, you know. And John was already a gadfly by that point, knew everybody, and he introduced me around. And you know, I got back to the law office and was like, this is a giant pile of suck. You know, that and some other events conspired to give me the opportunity to go out to Seattle. And so I did. And any sane person would have fled screaming from Pagan Publishing at the time. I think at the time it was Blair Reynolds. Blair Reynolds was living here. John Crow, Dennis Detweiler, and John Tynes were all in the same building together. And they're going to take me on as another roommate. And my two favorite parts about Delta Green, about Pagan Publishing at the time, were the hideous couch, which some months after I moved in, Blair and I conspired to murder the hideous couch. It was this couch that had been used by the cats as a toilet for so long that there was no conceivable way of removing the cat stink from it, short of burning it. And one day Blair and I just looked at each other and said, you know, this thing has got to go. Nobody else is home. While there's no discussion about it, let's get rid of it. But the hideous couch was not as entertaining as the other piece of furniture in the living room, which was a chair that had two legs missing from it, which they were sitting in. I mean, there are two legs missing from one side. So the chair is sitting at this bizarre non-Euclidean angle, and they're still sitting in it, you know, watching television. And I don't know if it was my first couple of days there. I said, "Hey, is anyone?" I said, "Can we put the where are the legs for it?" I said, "Well, the legs won't go back on, and they're broken." I'm like, "Oh, all right. Well, why don't we take off the other two legs, and then it'll sit flat on the floor?" And at that point, I think they were like, "Oh, it's a good thing you brought this Glancy into the process." Now, clearly, he has something to contribute to Pagan Pulp.
This is a man who solves problems.
Yeah, solved the chair problem. Let's move on. So anyways, Ken Height had described Pagan Publishing as alternately a frat house for serial killers. And I think his line was something that's all cat piss and speed loaders over there. And there was some truth to that. I'm still here in the same house that I moved into, but over the years, there has been a distinctly female touch added to the place with my wife Jane, and we had a roommate who's a friend of hers, Mish McIntyre, moved in, and they did a wonderful job of making sure that this place did not turn into something that was going to be seen on Hoarders.
Right.
Because that's definitely the direction it was going
for a while. Or America's Most Wanted.
Yeah. Yeah, you have John Tynes on the porch with his shirt off and the cops with their headlights on it, you know. But, you know, I came in, I had a little money of my own, and I came in and threw it at the company, and we sort of got Countdown out of that, and, you know, that's sort of how I got started at Pagan. And as time went by, you know, John wanted to move on to the real money and the computer game industry, and you know, was less and less interested in how he spent his time, even though, yeah, okay, Pagan's fun, but I have these goals that involve reproduction and marriage and you know, property ownership. So when he moved on, he, you know, sort of left the company in my hands, and I have sort of inherited it in lieu of all the back pay that we could never afford to pay me. Mm-hmm. So, you know, ta-da, now, you know, we've got, we own Pagan Publishing, and, or at least the majority share of Pagan Publishing. There are a few other shareholders. And that's all there is to that story, I guess.
Yeah. Well, all right. All right, well, Scott, it's been nice talking to you. Oh, no.
Yeah, I do have a tendency to go on, so feel free to pull that leash back in before I burn up all the time you want to use talking about, you know, cat piss and speed loaders.
Oh, not at all.
Well, I think the listeners this is the Delta Green audience. I mean,
okay.
If you remember, I remember at the Gen Con panel, you said if you sold this as a lifestyle, it would be what everybody would be, you know, paranoids in their rooms, armed to the teeth. As opposed to the vampire.
Yeah, players. We really can't sell the Delta Green lifestyle the way the way White Wolf sold the vampire lifestyle. You know, lots of suits, sunglasses, and disposable burn phones. You know,
One of the things you mentioned is, you know, what obviously you've done a lot of work on the Unspeakable Oath. Like, what kind of and you mentioned touched on this. Well, we touched on this in the. In the Delta Green panel, but for those that didn't listen, what kind of material do you like seeing in terms of submissions in the Oath?
Well, yeah, and I was curious about this because, Scott, you missed the sort of the bulk of that part of the discussion at Gen Con because you were doing that other stuff. So I was kind of curious, sort of from your perspective as a reader, as a gamer, you know, what do you get the most mileage out of from the Oath?
I tell you, the things that I get the most mileage out of are not necessarily scenarios. I've always enjoyed the mysterious manuscripts. I've always enjoyed the arcane artifacts. And I think expanding that to include standalone NPCs that are going to spice up games, people, things, books that can be dropped into a game at any time to sort of give a keeper, you know, a MacGuffin for which the players can be struggling for, an adversary that they can overcome. That stuff always seems a lot more useful than scenarios to me. Mm-hmm. But that's because, you know, I coming up with the scenarios is not necessarily a problem for me. I've been doing it for, ugh, have I been doing it for over 30 years? Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. You know, all the way back to Dungeons and Dragons in junior high school. So that's not my big thing. The thing that I'm most interested in is sort of, you know, background material and source material, something that'll be an inspiration to build a game around, you know, just those little nuggets like that. Obviously, the thing I want to see the most of in The Oath is stuff that I write, because then I get free copies of The Oath, which is awesome. And, you know, I get to see my name in print and, you know, boost my otherwise flagging ego. So I'm very much in favor of seeing more stuff by me.
Right.
But, you know, one of the things that we used to have in The Oath a lot that I hope we'll have some more of is we used to have a lot of period piece sort of stuff where people would go like, okay, here's the history of the Tommy gun, everything you need to know about Tommy guns from concept to, you know, when it's obsolete, and articles on, you know, forensics or law enforcement through the ages, so that players who are playing the non-modern stuff can be able to work that period piece stuff in. There was an article we had on technology. Now, you know, and when is it, when are the players going to see a refrigerator, you know, in a home in Call of Cthulhu, you know? We had a game where one of the things that was sort of one of the big giant clues in the game was the fact that there was a refrigerator in a private residence in the early 1920s, and that was incredibly, for us, that's nothing, but for 1922 or whatever, it was incredibly suspicious and unheard of. Not a cold box, not a, you know, not the place where you go to the butcher shop and you pick up the meat you're going to eat that day or the next day, but, you know, an actual electrically powered freezer unit was something unheard of in a private residence. So little things like that that can be used as plot turning points based on, you know, the sort of the conventions of the era is always pretty good. Aaron Vanek wrote an amazing thing, an amazing scenario. I think it may have ended up as a Chaosium monograph about where it was all about childbirth, where he used all this 1920s childbirth information to make the players think that they're facing some sort of Rosemary's Baby situation, when the truth of the matter is all this strange, wiggy, inexplicable childbirth stuff was just standard operating procedure.
Yeah, I think I've read that scenario. That sounds familiar.
I don't think it was Worlds of Cthulhu. I don't know if it was in Worlds of Cthulhu. I don't think it was, but it's. I think it was in a monograph. Certainly, his two scenarios he wrote for the monograph. He wrote something about Venice Beach in the 1920s, and something about Catalina Island. It was really amazing that it all sort of involved, you know, the weirdness that was Venice and Catalina, where they were, you think of them as the Venice Beach as a city, but when it was created, it was actually a giant amusement park. I mean, it was a city built for one thing, and that was to be a diversion. It was developed as a private enterprise thing. So, you know, it comes off as very weird to our 21st century sensibilities, that there's a city that is essentially a private enterprise.
Right.
But that's the way it worked. You know, little things like that are always, I always enjoy that. And perhaps there's less use for some of that now with access to the information age and the internet, where people can, you know, can look up facts or things like that online, but
I think the value in that kind of thing is in how you present it and how you put it together. You know, I mean, for me, yes, I can go on the internet and spend half a day piecing together details about what, say, daily life was like for a 1920s news reporter. But if I had an 8-page magazine article that laid all that out, where somebody else had already done all that background, then I could read that in 30 minutes and have what I need.
One of the things I've considered trying to put together is something on clipping services, because I have a friend who actually works one of the last clipping services in the country. And
Jesus, they're still around?
Yes, yes, they are, because apparently, because Google doesn't solve everything. Apparently, only 20% of the, it's like 25% of the material that appears in print is then repeated online by the same publishers. The New York Times, like Washington Post, all these newspapers and such, only put about 25% of their material online.
Right, right.
And that leaves tons of other material that is not. And a friend of mine works for a clipping service, and clipping services in the 1920s, it's the freaking Google. It's the internet of the 1920s. You've got, instead of an algorithm doing it, you've got people in a room reading newspapers, clipping them out, sorting them into files, you know?
Right.
And it's one of those dirty, cheap investigator tricks I love to do in Call of Cthulhu, where it's like, you know, we need to throw a net wide to look for a problem or look for something that's going on. Boom, we, you know, hire the clipping service, and, you know, maybe it'll, rather than, you know, the thing where the players have to go down to the newspaper morgue and do it themselves.
Right, library use, rinse, repeat, you know.
Yeah, exactly. When you don't have library use, but you maybe have access to a few shekels.
Yeah, credit rating.
You throw that at the problem. Yeah, there's a skill that's sort of terribly underused.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Credit rating. But anyways, moving along, that's the kind of thing I'd love to see is I like to see, you know, things that can, arcane artifacts, those little one-off MacGuffins and things that can be used to be dropped into a game to help spice up a keeper's, you know, campaign setting, things like that. And of course, the because Call of Cthulhu started off as a period piece game, anything that's going to sort of give the players access to some period piece information that will enhance the game, that will, right, you know, not just, oh, and here's the life of, here's what it's like, you know, to work, I don't know, in an auto plant in 1925. but, you know, something that's actually going to, you know, make things more interesting. I mean, God knows we lost. There's a game John Crow has told me about where they lost some players because the car they bought in 1920, whatever, was a crank start. And they ran back to the car and were like, okay, we're making our fast getaway. And he's like, well, start cranking the car. And here comes the dark young guy, you know, stomping through the woods. And, you know, one guy's pushing the ignition, the guy's cranking it, you know. And, oh, they don't make it. They die horribly because technology failed them utterly.
Yeah.
The
assumption for modern gamers is you get in a car and you go.
Right. Right.
If you don't have the context of this car doesn't work like that.
Yeah. Throw on top of that, you know, the telephone line of the era, so much your rural telephone lines are party lines, where if the players are on the phone calling from two locations, I found out where the cult is at, and the cult's in the town, and they got somebody listening on the open phone line. Oops,
right.
You know, you blown it. If you start talking, if you start, you know, running your mouth on the open line in a small town and there's some secret you'd like to keep, you've blown it.
Mm-hmm.
This is something that the players wouldn't even consider in the modern age.
Right,
you know,
right.
Sure, the government might listen in, you know, maybe when they're playing Delta Green Agents, you know, you got your burner cell phone. But there's still aspects of that sort of communication security in the 20s that people would not necessarily consider, you know. So that's the kind of thing I'd like to see.
You know what I'd like to see? Mm-hmm. Some sort of material that, you know, you mentioned underutilized skill. Of course, this is a personal goal of mine. Someday I'm going to write a scenario or write some sort of material to make the focus of a Call of Cthulhu game the operate heavy machinery skill. I want to do something where you use bulldozers to fight the mythos.
Well, that's actually not a terrible idea. The idea where you could take a one-page article.
Yeah.
And you could pull out a skill. Any skill in the game, you go, all right, nobody, you know, art or whatever, and how, you know, underused art is, or credit
natural
rating.
History.
Or some suggestions on, you know, ways to spin that into your scenario. You know,
exactly.
You
know, something like that would be, you know, I'll just take a skill out and go, okay, you know, don't forget this, you know, all this stuff's in here for a reason. Mm-hmm. You know, here's the ways you can use these sort of underused skills or underused things like that to enhance the game. That would be, that would be worth a page.
And that way, if your players did, you know, one of your players did get a wild hair and sink points into one of those crazy skills, then here's a way you can make use of it.
Yeah, I mean, operate heavy machinery, Ross. That's everything. I mean, it kind of covers everything from bulldozers to maybe locomotives to tanks to, you know, it's kind of one of those catch-all skills. But yes, I look forward to the day that some players get to use a wrecking ball on a crane to smack a Dark Young with.
Yeah.
Who knows? That might actually work. You know. But something like that would be worthwhile. And something that Ken Height threw out, which I thought was kind of interesting. We did this once with some spells, where we threw out some spells. John Crow wrote an article, I think it was called Changing Spells or Warping Spells, where he took some spells out of the book and, you know, sort of expanded on them. You know, like, you know, withering. Let's take shrivel. You know, there's nothing in the, it didn't say anything about it in the rules, but can players contribute magic points to a shriveling spell? Mm-hmm. So everyone stands around, joins hands, then zot, it actually worth something, because, you know, with that one hit point per magic point burned, players are going to be passing out from lack of magic points, you know, before they even get done killing the monster.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, things like that. He had some ideas for the Dread Curse of Azathoth, where, you know, you steal power from the monster if the spell works. What if it creates a need to keep stealing power? Where you suddenly become like a power vampire, where it affects you like that, or the resurrection spell, the classic resurrection spell. There's this implication in the story that never really made it into the original rules that. The resurrective hunger. You bring somebody back this way and they they need copious amounts of blood.
Blood and fresh meat. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So,
well, there's also the very implicit thing that if the essential salts are incomplete, you create a, you know, monster instead of the thing you're trying to resurrect. So
that's pretty well documented, but some of the other stuff didn't quite make it in there. And so going through and taking out spells out of the grimoire and perhaps expanding on them, making them a little more, fleshing them up a little bit.
I could see a lot of value in doing the same sort of thing just with, you know, take an individual monster, you know.
Yeah.
And both of those address that recurring core problem of, you know, we all know what a Bayaki does.
Yeah.
You know, we all know what the Dread Curse of Azathoth does when we see somebody, you know, gearing up to use it or whatever. So yeah, I'd love to see more material on myself on both of those fronts.
Ken had mentioned something about, you know, something about the monsters during the panel, I think, about, you know, trying to come up with new ways of presenting the same old critters rather than, you know, just going into the big random monster generation table, roll for eyes, roll for mouths, roll for legs, you know. Mm-hmm. Okay, now it's the spawn of, you know, whatever the new spawn is.
The tough thing is that for me, the challenge is if you're going to have a new monster, you know, I would want to start from what do I want to accomplish with this? You know, I mean, what kind of a story am I trying to make emerge from using this particular monster? And the existing monsters, you already know what kind of a story you're going to get when you throw in deep ones, you know, or when you throw in a Dark Young, you know. And so you've got that going for you. And so if you have some ways to sort of change them around, then you can keep that shortcut, you know, and then try to make it fresh. And I think actually that's room for a whole other article, actually, is stuff on ways to create new mythos monsters that's meaningful and that's not just, you know, it's a collection of tentacles. What do you do?
Yeah, I oftentimes I actually balk when people throw out a new critter. Mostly because I guess when some of the new critters that have been thrown out at us from submissions and things come off, they just came off as not terribly interesting. You know, they came off as the big pile of arms and legs and tentacles and mouths. And so I tend to balk at that. But then, you know, I went ahead and did it for Targets of Opportunity, for the Children of the Worm. You know, that's not in the mythos anywhere. Right. That's just something I pulled, pulled out of nowhere.
Pulled out of your ass, so to speak.
I really didn't want to say that.
It's just there waiting for you.
I guess you could hear me like shying away from the ass joke right there. Yeah.
But nice. That's the thing is with that monster, you know, yes, it's sort of a new thing and, you know, but you also build, you know, this big storyline around it. And that's what it needs. I mean, if it was just a collection of stats on one page and it's a monster that, you know, that rapes you, then, you know, that's it's kind of, you know, okay, it's there's something icky about that, but it's not really compelling. But if it's that and then it's got this entire setting and set of characters and history built around encounters with this monster, you know, that becomes amazing reading and amazingly valuable for a campaign.
And, you know, when I couldn't agree more that the new set of stats attached to a new set of, you know, a new sand loss roll just doesn't get you anywhere. And certainly I've seen plenty of that. But it's not the stuff that, you know, it's not the stuff that gets published. We always wanted something that's going to be a little more rich and feel like even if you don't tell its entire story, you imply that there is, you've got to have a way to imply that there is an entire story that you're only getting to see a piece of, as long as you can sell that sort of feeling, you know, that you're not stealing the whole thing, but, you know, there is a whole thing out there. That's when it starts to feel, you know, that's when it starts to feel pertinent and more
right,
than just...
Right, right. Well, I mean, in Lovecraft's original stuff, I mean, and in the better Cthulhu Mythos stories, you know, I mean, the color, he designed the color out of space for a specific narrative purpose. Mm-hmm. You know, he had a story in mind, and that evolved from that, you know. He didn't just put Cthulhu together and its attributes randomly, you know. He had that's the approach that I think you need to take as a gamer too, is you know, think ahead of what kind of an investigation is going to result from this, and what kind of experience is going to result from how this is put together.
I got to tell you, when it comes to even, you know, coming up with new critters, I also, you know, always recommend people just go and read some, you know, go back to the material, and maybe you can glean something out of the original material that'll work for you better. I mean, I know that there was a Chaosium scenario that is a sort of a notorious dungeon crawl. It's the Bishop family and their giant, crazy mortuary of doom in New York.
sounds pretty standard.
I don't remember it, but yeah.
It was all, I want to say it was, it had a whole bunch of Nagatha stuff going on in it, I think. The Bishop family is, I want to say that they were some sort of, I think this, they were some sort of like formless spawn hybrids. And again, that's one of the things that always struck me as a little annoying was, you know, well, we're going to have another hybrid. We're going to, you know, it's the spawn of Azathoth. It's the spawn of Yogg-Sothoth. It's the, you know, we're going to keep adding, you know, some sort of hybrid to the thing. And that's your new monster. And I didn't much care for it until I, you know, sort of dug up that Clark Ashton Smith actually has a story, a very good story, in fact, that involves a sort of a mixed blood worshiper of Sathagwa who has aspects of a formless spawn to them. And, you know, that was where the critters That's where the cultists actually from Dig to Victory come from. Although the recorded game, you guys never even got near the cultists. There were some human, half-human hybrid followers, and you know, I wasn't comfortable. It's funny, I wasn't comfortable with the monster when it looked like it was pulled out of nowhere. But once you know, I read through the original short stories and realized it was not, and it actually came from the literature. I got a little more comfortable in using it, but maybe that's probably just me being a snob more than anything else. Where, you know, but certainly going back through the original literature and finding things that are worth exploiting is you know something else that I think will help. And whether it's Lovecraft or it's any of the you know folks who've come after him, there's always the potential for something new.
Yeah. Well, let's move on to another thing. Sort of taking a step back from the Oath and in a bigger picture sense, with Call of Cthulhu. Sort of, what do you like best in Call of Cthulhu as a game, and what do you wish that it would do differently? Like, are there elements of the game that you sort of find yourself skirting around or changing in play because they irritate you?
I would say that the one thing that perhaps annoys me about if they had any gripes about the game is that I like its simplicity, but sometimes that simplicity means that the game is far too physically lethal for the PCs. I don't mind the PCs having enough hit points to survive being shot once. I mean, that's fine. I mean, we've sort of accepted the fragility of Call of Cthulhu characters, you know, and that works fine for me. But I guess there's no mechanic in the game that allows for not getting hit. You're getting shot, stabbed, clawed is pretty much based on the enemy's abilities, and none of it is based on yours.
Well, there is the dodge skill. I mean,
There is a dodge skill, and that helps considerably. But in firearms combat, that can be a little more troubling. I like to use a hit location with cover. If your players are behind a concrete, you know, a bunch of sandbags, and they get a hit location on their leg, that should be a miss. And it should work the same way when they're firing back, thus making firearms combat a little more difficult. Oh, I have an 80 in rifle. I'm going to hit every time. Well, you know, sure, you're going to hit that man-sized target, but it's not a man-sized target anymore. It's just a head and an arm sticking around a corner. If you want to hit that target, now you got to go to 20% of your skill and do a called location shot. That's fine, I guess. It can bog the combat down a little bit using hit location. And I don't really, haven't really put any thought into how you could make it a, you know, you'd have to leave the world of percentage skill resolution, I think, to make this any different. I think I was looking through Hollow Earth Expeditions and their system, and they have a sort of system where players have a natural defense ability, you know, that goes up like anything else. And you just subtract your defense from their attack. And that, you know, is the sort of your natural ability to dodge, weave, not present a target, you know, use cover. Mm-hmm. It represents that in a very, very non-specific way.
Hollow Earth Expedition. It is real abstract. I mean, it basically conflates ducking and weaving with how physically tough you are and whatever else, all in one sort of thing. What you mentioned reminded me of RuneQuest originally. If I remember right, like first and second edition didn't even have a dodge skill. They had a defense rating, which was a static penalty to your attackers. Like, you had a defense rating based on how good your dex was and whatever, and you might have a defense of 10 or a defense of 15, and that just knocked that percentage chance off of the chance to hit you.
Yeah, certainly that's something that, you know, if I was going to do sort of a Conan-esque swords and sandals low fantasy game using the Call of Cthulhu mechanics, I would have to come up with some sort of skill of in combat that just is again, your defensive skill, like dodge, except instead of being something you have to use every turn, you know, dodge is a skill you have to use rather than attack. But rather than that, call it a skill that, you know, if I have 45% in it, that just knocks 45% off the other guy's attack. And if it's a bunch of peasants running up to smack Conan with their, you know, hose and pitchforks, he's not going to get a scratch. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, he's just going to knock the, unless somebody gets a critical hit or something, rolls an 0-1, sure, but he's going to be able to just, you know, zip right through them and have those kind of high fantasy level fights where, you know, outnumbered 6-1 or whatever and still end up coming out the other side without crippling injuries that are going to keep you out of the game for the rest of the game. That kind of thing, you know, that's something I wouldn't mind seeing. Well,
the cover stuff is something we did in Target. So that was one of the optional rules things that I put in the back of the book, was this set of, you know, this basically really simple set of ideas where, you know, if you have whatever level of cover you're taking, you know, it mm-hmm. essentially gives you a penalty to hit because you're spending your time ducking away. But it gives a bigger penalty for people to hit you because you've got all the stuff in front of you. And there's that kind of this chart thing. Well, so apart from combat stuff.
Well, there's some combat things that I would change up, you know, and you know, perhaps the automatic weapons rules are a little bit broken. And then the more bullets you fire, the more accurate you are. You know, which everything I've ever heard suggests that may be the exact opposite in real life. But at the same time, you know, I there are ways to fudge that again in the game with sort of hasty fire and panic fire rules that John Crow came up with. But again, it starts getting into a lot of math. Mm-hmm. It relies on percentages of your percentage rather than knocking off straight points off your percentage roll. But you know, I'm not afraid of the math. It's just that sometimes in a con situation, I need to make those calculations in advance for the pre-gen so that, you know, they have their regular skill roll, their hasty fire skill roll, their panic fire skill roll right there on the sheet so you can just do it. The only other things that, you know, let's see, there's anything about COC that particularly annoys me. No, I'm relatively happy with the sand system, as simplistic as it is. I'm happy with the magic system, as hard as it is, as difficult as it is to use magic in the game. I think that it should be that way. I don't want the game to, you know, sort of devolve into the Dresden Files. Mm-hmm. It's a different feel. It's a different, you know, sensibility, zeitgeist of the game.
Right.
I don't really have a lot of problems with the game at all on the grounds that I've been willing to use COC rules to play Twilight 2000, you know, or any other genre that I cared to use, because they're butt simple, they're quick to learn, and again, just you know, the rules don't get in the way of the story, which is also handy, for the most part.
And they allow you to be flexible if you want to fudge stuff.
Yeah, I might complain because Chaosium merged zoology and botany into one skill. You know, and I'm like, I'm sorry, why is the botanist going to be able to tell us about, you know, the footprints of the animal we just ran across, you know? But okay, whatever, you know, that's something I can fudge out in my house rules and break the skill up again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but those are really minor complaints. They came up with it. They got a good system in 81, and they really have not had to make a lot of major changes since then. The only, like I said, the only thing that worries me is that that I worry about is I would like, I don't mind the characters being fragile, but some of their mechanics options to preserve them a little better and just not getting hit would be fine. That would be something I'd like to see. Certainly, there's some You know, there's some mythos critters there. When you're going to unleash them on the players, you know, you just it's just going to be ugly. In fact, I was, you know, I was one of the games I ran was something for Frank Frey where called Jump in the Darkness. He wrote a sort of World War II Delta Green scenario involving a bunch of U.S. troops versus a mythos monster, and you know, it's got this 90% attack rating. With a 3d6 damage, you know, it's got a damage bonus, and I'm like, well, that's going to kill everybody. But during the playtest, the freaking monster rolled double-aught 99 on three of its attacks, and they killed it. You know, it fumbled three attack rolls, not just missed, but fumbled. And you know, as a result, the players were able to finally do this thing in, despite its 9 points of armor and all kinds of other advantages it had. So. You know, maybe I shouldn't sweat. the player fragility, because they, you know, oftentimes they do find a way to, if they're using their brains, you know, as long as they don't go with the sort of kick the door, have a fight, take the stuff approach, they're gonna come through it.
That actually reminds me of another thing I was gonna ask you about, which is. Is sort of the difference between doing one shots and doing long term games. You know, I mean, obviously you've done tons of one shots because of all the stuff at the conventions and everything else. But yeah. What's been your experience, or have you had much with ongoing long term Call of Cthulhu campaigns?
Well, I haven't run a lot of campaigns. I will say that I've been in a few. John Crow's running us through some Wild West material set up in Montana. And I have a character who survived some one-shots and then went on to get into this, you know, this longer-term campaign. And John sprinkles the campaign with non-mythos events, non-mythos problems. You know, there's going to be a... I don't want to reveal too much because John gets hinky when I talk about stuff online. But he'll do things where there's like trouble. There's trouble down at the bank or whatever, or there's a bar fight, or there's the stage is going to get robbed or something like that. And you'll have these events that are non-mythos, but you end up using your skills, which means you get all these skill checks in the game. Fighting non-mythos problems, you're still fighting guys who'll kill you dead, or the town drunk is firing a shotgun off in the middle of town, you know, and it's a mining town, so there's no law, and you're the guys who end up having to either ignore the problem or try and talk him down. Well, you know, you end up with all these skill checks, and I've been like, you know, this character I've gotten has got his skills are now through the roof from having survived all this stuff and having and played for so long. You know, I'm a little impressed with how far the character has developed. I mean, he can still get squashed like a bug in a second. But that's worked out pretty well. The only other campaign that I am working on a campaign for Delta Green, but sadly it is set up like a series of one shots because I want to spread it over like 70 years. Hmm. And each chapter of the campaign is, you know, as the players get to be too old to be in the service, then they bring in a new character who's like their protege. There will be some. It'll take place during Delta Green's official time period, and then eventually jump forward into the present, where perhaps the original players, if they survive, you know, the earlier chapters, can show up as consultants, even if they're in a wheelchair or if they're in a old folks or the, you know, a veterans home or something like that. They can still provide information. And of course, part of it is that they, anything that they learn during the earlier chapters, if they, depending on how they record it, that's going to make a difference as to what the players in later chapters are going to have to work with. Right. Now, that's a series of one-shots where they can be, you know, as long as I don't have a TPK, the campaign can kind of continue. And even if there is a TPK, there's the structure of Delta Green in place to bring in a new set of players or a new set of characters. You know, I I haven't had to deal. And again, what Shane, remembering it, you had said at Gen Con many years ago, you had these very professional groups of players who were cautious enough not to get the giant sand hits, not to just kick the door in and go, oh, damn, we shouldn't have come in the middle of the ceremony. Blah, there goes 1d20 or 1d100 sand points. For guys playing in a campaign, that's the way it's, they're going to have to play like that. They're going to have to play very careful, very close to the chest, never stick their heads out more than they absolutely positively have to. I don't have a problem with the players playing like that. It's not what you do in a one shot at a con.
Right.
I mean, those obviously have to be a little more wahoo over the top sometimes. Yeah, for a campaign, they're gonna have to shepherd their sanity and their hit points a lot more closely. John's Wild West campaign is the one campaign that I've played in recently. I'm playing in what is called a scenario right now, but I'm fairly certain it's not a scenario. It's been going on forever with Blair Reynolds, and we're watching our. We're watching our sand points just march down, tumbling down. Like, I think the line from somebody was, I haven't seen sand loss like this since college, back when they were playing Masks, or something, or Dark's Carnival or something like that. And it's pretty gruesome. I don't expect this character to survive in any functional way after the campaign. The one thing I've learned playing with Blair is that you're never going to see that character again. All the most horrible shit that has ever happened to my characters has happened playing in a game where Blair was the moderator. And you're the lucky guy to escape with both arms gone and all the other players are dead. I mean, either gunned down or devoured by horrible insects from the Precambrian, and I just got away with no arms. Oh, awesome. I just have to find someone to wipe my ass for the rest of my life, and I'm good to go. I've had players, most of my players, the characters that have died playing in his games. Even if they survived multiple games to get to that point, and they all had, boom, you show up in his, they're just very, very deadly, and you're just gonna, and that's just a keeper by keeper basis of what to do as a player. As a keeper, I'm very happy with the Delta Green campaign world, because you can keep a campaign going without having to drag the guy with 7 sand points to Shanghai after, things didn't go so great at the Mountain of the Black Wind in Kenya. Right. Under normal circumstances, that guy is done, with his 7 sand points. I'm not going to Shanghai, you're sending him home, but because it's Mask and that's all you got, you drag him to the next horrifying location that he's just not going to make it out of. I mean, there's just, almost no way he's going to survive that. And so, I would certainly be as generous as possible with monster killing points, getting your sand points bent for that.
Yeah, you'd have to.
Have to be generous with the sand points getting back, succeeding at minor things. And by minor, I mean just like saving somebody's life, making something like that happen, I'd have to reward some sand points back for that. Maybe even treat sand points a little bit like style points or fortune points in other games where
right, as rewards, yeah.
Yeah, if the player who, has made a clean getaway, but then goes back to get the players who are trapped rather than just leave them back there. If they do still make it out, if that second attempt gets not, then throw some more sand points at them because of their actions.
One thing I like to do in that mold is if a player does a really good job of playing into a character's personality, you know.
Yes.
And I, what I like about doing that is not only is that sort of, you know, it's extra sand, and it's also that kind of meta reward, but it's a meta reward that feels like it fits within the story because, you know, it's a character, you know, you've got a character who's kind of being consistent with himself in some way. And, you know, so, especially, and what I like to do that is especially if you've got a player who sticks to his guns and makes decisions that are in keeping with the character's personality and decisions and that fuck over everybody else.
Thank you, Greg Stolzing.
Yeah. Then you get sanity from me for doing that, even if everybody else hates you.
No, I agree with that completely. And the threats in Call of Cthulhu are so brutal. Even ghouls, you know, are so brutal that, you know, I don't think you need to, I don't think you need to throw, you look at some of these old Chaosium scenarios where it's like, oh, you go in and there's three dark young.
Roll for initiative. Yeah.
What, three? I mean, there's one, I can't remember which scenario it is. It's the one where it's one of the ones from like South America where you're going.
The Temple of the Moon, I think, is one you're thinking about.
Yeah, it is. It's that double adventure, Temple of the Moon. You're going, and there's three dark young, and it's like after the players deal with the dark young. Right. You know what is this, Tolkien? No, I mean, give me a ring. How are they going to deal with the dark young? Did you deck them out with you know, Yithian lightning guns before they got down? You know, but you know, if there's a, you know, I mean, John Crow, unleashes horrible shit on us all the time, and you know, even though it's, and to the one time in a game that a dark young showed up, we shit our pants because we, you know, he'd been killing us with stuff that didn't even remotely come up to the firepower of a dark young,
right?
So when it turned up with its sneak of 80 or whatever it is, you know, and we're in the woods and we're like, oh God, you know, we were done with the whole being in the woods thing at that point. That was never going to happen again. But it really, when you actually bring out some big nasty like that, it should be a fucking event. Same thing with the spell books, you know. I'd played games with John Crow for, you know, like 5 years before a copy of Unaussprechlichen Kulten showed up. And when that happened, we all went, oh, crap, you know, it's real. You know, it's on now. He just dropped a Mythos tome into the game. That's never happened before. You know, all of us were like, oh, this is not going to be good. And little did we know how not good it was going to be, actually. Whatever our expectations of how bad it was going to be, no, it was worse. Yeah. It was so much worse.
Nice. Right.
Anyway,
speaking of German occultist terms, one of the things that I know has been brought up several times on the list and other people is the Delta Green adversary, Caro Tekia. How do you pronounce it? Where did that name come from?
I've told the story before, and I will tell it again. It is a complete mangle. Hmm. A friend of mine named Gregory Gillum, a guy who I. A number of my friends have turned up as NPCs in Delta Green, and Greg turned up as Greg Mason, one of the NPCs in the back of the Delta Green section. And he was telling me one time about this article that a professor of his had come across, which involved some, I want to say they were buried rail cars of old Nazi records that had been found in Poland. Or they were abandoned rail cars or something like this that had been found in Poland. It was all these records that were apparently related to Sonderkommando H, Special Unit H for Hexen, which was this unit in the SS that was going around with these sort of it was staffed by party hacks with delusions of academia. Much like the Ananerba, much like the Ancestral Heritage Research Foundation was staffed with guys who were either pseudoscientists or failed academics, you know, who now that we've got all those pesky Jews out of the university, now suddenly, you know, their cachet has been raised and they are doctors and professors and whatever. And they are, they were doing research on the witch trials in Europe, particularly in Germany, or and they were in real life, the Sonic Commando Ha was looking into finding material to use in an anti-Catholic pogrom in southern Germany to ultimately remove the German people's loyalty to the Catholic Church by coming up with this giant laundry list of medieval and late medieval, you know, sort of witch trial hysteria. You know, sort of murderous, torturous rampage that the Inquisition did, and, you know, recast it as a Catholic attack on German culture. And but at the same time, it's, you know, boxcars full of research on witch trials. You know, that seems odd. Hmm. His professor had found the article in a German magazine. And the title of the article was something like "The Science of Magic," and he read the name in German to my friend Greg, who then misremembered it, brought it back to me, and mispronounced it, and it came out sounding very much like Karatekia. And it stuck in my head, and I just went, well, that's the name. That's what I'm going to use. I'm going to call it Karatekia. What does it mean? You know, I don't know. What does Gatana Toa mean? All right. Okay. You know, it was just, it was the title of a magazine article that was, again, misremembered and mispronounced.
Were you ever able to track that back to the original?
No. This was something that would have come out in the early 90s, maybe, maybe late 80s even. He also had to throw a couple of years between when he talked about the article and when I started writing Delta Green stuff.
Right.
And, you know, the result is that it
created... And it's in German, right?
The article was in German.
Yeah.
Now I've read about Sonder Commando Ha since then, and everyone's read about the through the Gesellschaft and the Anna Nerba since then, the German Nazi archaeologists and the pre-Nazi, you know, mystics and all that, you know. So this was just a way to, you know, this is just a way to sort of bypass all the historical ones and throw up a something fictional that, again, I don't know, the name sounded cool. So, you know,
we can say in character it was inspired by the ghost of Hitler.
It was, or at least Himmler. Apparently, one of the things that was always sort of amusing about this German archaeology, German mystical stuff, Hitler was apparently kind of embarrassed by it. Himmler was always like, "We're digging up our glorious German past," you know, and Hitler's like, "It's a mud hut. It's a mud hut filled with, you know, clay pots. You're making us look like, you know, hairy barbarians." Oh, wait, we were.
Yeah.
You know? There's no marble-lined streets of Thule waiting for anyone, right, digging up German archaeology, you know, except in, you know, fantasy land, which is okay because the Germans went there. Mm-hmm. When it comes to their glorious past. But anyways, that's where the Karatekia comes from. There you go. I am sure I'll ask again later, but there you go.
No, it's on the record now. This will settle it forever for you.
One hopes.
So let me cut to I've got a couple of talking points from fans, and then I
fans, oh, what do they know?
Move on. So Mr. Brett Kramer, who's been
a great writer before. Brett Kramer is a great writer. I'm just going to say that right off the bat. Mm-hmm. And a very, very, very nice man to allow me to write up a fictionalized version of Last Things Last. Robin Laws came to me a while back and wanted some short story material for his new collection, Shotguns versus Cthulhu, sort of action-oriented Cthulhu stories. And I didn't have anything, you know, well, I mean, I had Once More from the Top, but they wanted something new.
Right.
So they went. I asked Brett if I could fictionalize his shotgun scenario from a few years back, Last Things Last. and was very graciously allowed that. And of course, we're still going to split the fee if I ever get paid for it. Mm-hmm. But Brett Kramer is one of my favorite writers of Mythos stuff, and I desperately want to find some places we can publish some of his stuff because it's good. It's all good.
I believe I've already got him in the Oath, so we're on top of it.
Yes.
And if I don't, then I apologize, Brett. We'll rectify that.
We really need to. It's in our interest because people will buy the stuff. It's good.
Yeah, he's sharp. So what he asks is, let's see. First of all, he says, if conspiracy and suspicion and distrust defined Delta Green in the 90s, how would you define it for the 2010s?
Well, it's, I don't know. It's all still there. I mean... Mm. We just had a population that was so terrified of these swarthy foreigners and their crazy religion, their crazy apocalyptic religion, that we embraced our government surveillance. We wanted more of it. We were upset that the government wasn't spying on us more, secretly spending dollars we can't account for more. You know, the era of the war on that first decade of the so-called war on terror, you know, comes off as there's all kinds of horrible shit that we should be shocked, appalled, and worried about our government doing. But we apparently, you know, the population took on the idea that, you know, there's nothing since my government, you know, except for again the people who are the truthers, mm-hmm. you know, with the 9/11 was an inside job and the whole controlled detonation of the World Trade Center thing, you know, except for those people, everyone decided that, you know, this other threat is more threatening than my government spying on me without a warrant, and my government holding me without a warrant, my government flying me secretly to a prison in Bulgaria where some very unsympathetic men with cattle prods will ask me some very direct questions. We weren't worried about that anymore. Because, first of all, it wasn't going to happen to us, the voting public. It was only going to happen to those, you know, suspicious, swarthy people who aren't real Americans, even if they have a, you know, even if they've been here for a generation, they got that funny religion that, you know, isn't really American. So we're going to just go ahead and turn a blind eye to that and be safe. And of course, you know, right there, we're going to be safe. That sounds like the perfect thing to exploit there, just how safe you're not.
Mm-hmm. That's the issue, is sort of how does that inform Delta Green, which was kind of predicated on the fear of all those things before they actually came true and came true to widespread approval.
Yeah, I mean, the idea that, oh my God, the government has a secret prison where they perform, you know, enhanced interrogations, and where'd we put it? In Puerto Rico. Mm-hmm. But wait, the real one's in, you know, Cuba and Guantanamo Bay. whoops. Right. Oddly enough, the Outlook group was based on a Marine base, so I guess we got that part right now, because Guantanamo is on a Marine base, or a Marine camp. And, you know, so there is that aspect of it, that it came true. Some of these government out-of-control things came true in ways that, again, we wouldn't have predicted. I certainly wouldn't have seen the rise in military contractors, mm-hmm. Which I guess I should have. I mean, it's a fabulous way to do the work of 10 men with one person. And by that, I mean, the one guy who's a military contractor gets 10 times the salary of the poor bastard who's actually in the army. I'm not saying that they do 10 times the work. I really don't think they do. I'm actually quite the, quite grumpy about the whole military contractor thing. I think it's an enormous waste of our resources. It was just a great way to funnel cash into from the public sector to the private sector.
Right.
It's not a waste at all if you're an investor in Blackwater.
No, no, it's not called Blackwater anymore. So there's no more Blackwater.
Or right. G.
Yeah. My bad.
Whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah, whatever. I mean, The change of the name of Blackwater reminds me of that bit from was it Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, where they have the cloning machine they can't turn off without killing a clone. I mean, there's always the one clone is being finished when the next one's being started, so they can't turn the machine off without killing one of the clones. And so the engineers are thrown at the problem first, and when that fails, they put the lawyers on it, who try to redefine murder, and then ultimately attempt to respell the word. That'll fix it. It's murder with a Q, not the regular murder. It doesn't count.
Yeah.
So, anyways,
that's how we've done away with torture in the United States.
Yes, exactly. We don't have torture. We have enhanced interrogation.
To bring that back to Delta Green, that's sort of the thematic challenge of Delta Green in the 2010s is a lot of that stuff that it was sort of responding to and those fears that it kind of encapsulated.
They were kind of
embraced.
I think sort of a public side to it too, because you have things like the TSA. And this sort of security theater where they do these incredibly expensive and very useless in practical terms programs to take your shoes off and have this safer. Enhanced.
Don't you feel safer?
Yeah, exactly.
I feel safer.
So you have all this kind of wasted effort and resources in order to make the public think that you're safer. So I think that could also apply in some ways to a Delta Green, game of the 2010s where you're like, well, we solved the problem, but, there's still that burning building, those corpses. So we have to come up with some sort of convincing sort of story, or we have to now spend half the effort. Half a scenario.
The players in Delta Green should have some advantages in this era. Even if they play the classic illegal cell structure, you show up with an FBI badge and start asking questions. There's going to be a large percentage of the population. You're going to be more enthusiastic about answering your questions as the authorities. I think that. There would be a shift to, is it important? Is it national security? Am I involved? Is this like a Jack Ryan novel? People are going to, be more enthusiastically hopeful of the authorities. Maybe ask less questions. Take it to heart when they actually say, we were never here. Don't tell anybody. That probably won't last until they get to Facebook. I saw some FBI agents. They said not to tell anyone they're here. As far as I don't think that the elements are still there of being afraid of the hidden world. It's just that what was the hidden world in the 90s isn't hidden anymore. A lot of it's out in public, or at least out in public enough so that people. Are comfortable with it. When they actually showed pictures of when they actually see stuff from Abu Ghraib, a large percent of the population recoiled in horror at that when they actually saw what was that enhanced interrogation apparently involved a lot of fraternity initiation pranks combined with an enormous amount of homoerotic humiliation. Mm-hmm. Suddenly everyone's a little uncomfortable with that. What's his name? The Florida congressman, one of our new congressman from Florida who actually ended up leaving the army because, while in Iraq, he was firing his pistol off behind the head of a guy he was interrogating, some Iraqi or maybe it was Afghan. I think it was Iraqi policeman that he was sure the guy was a double agent for Al-Qaeda. And, they threatened to blow his brains out and fired the gun behind his head while he was making excuses about, I don't know what you're talking about. I don't work for Al-Qaeda. Bang, And apparently it turned into quite the scandal. And he, he's not in the army anymore, but he's in Congress.
Mm-hmm.
The underlying theme
that we have to deal with is not that there are all these sort of secret conspiracies to seize power, but the power's already been seized, and it's been seized in a way that has widespread approval behind it. And what does that mean?
And certainly that is one of the things we can do with it. However, we're still not far away from the classic Call of Cthulhu problem in when it comes to that, you know, small group of people with limited resources, if you make your hypergeometry and hard metaphysics work, oh wow, it's so much better than a briefcase nuke. Mm-hmm. If you make Cthulhu turn up or Ithaqua or whatever. And it does. Cultists have always had this shape in the classic period that looked like terrorists, right. You know, and had goals that were like terrorists, you know, big giant pile of bodies.
That kind of reminds me. I read something about terrorist tactics over like the last 30 years, and back decades ago, people like the IRA and even Middle Eastern terrorists would actually warn people, often call up to warn people that, oh, we're placing a bomb. We're going to bomb this place so there wouldn't be any casualties. The idea was to damage the government but not take out, civilians, collateral damage. And then now, in the last 10, 20 years, it's sort of shifted towards the casualties are the goal. They just want to cause as much damage as possible. They don't want to negotiate with the government. They want to overthrow it. I mean, that's what the IRA did. They used bombings as a negotiation tactic. So,
well, certainly now with the religious aspect involved in there, yeah, okay, there's a religious aspect in the north to the Irish problem, too.
Yeah, yeah.
Nowadays, it seems to me that with the religious aspect, we're really dealing with is the suicide bomb. Blowing yourself up is the point. Whether or not you actually hurt the enemy or cause some tactical, even strategic damage, it is all about demonstrating your faith. It's an act of demonstration of faith to blow yourself up. What blows up with you is almost pointless as long as you demonstrate your willingness to be a shaheed, I think is the term for martyr. That religious aspect certainly is so alien to us in the West that, it smacks of the, it harkens back to the kind of xenophobia that, Lovecraft had and with dusky foreigners, and by dusky foreigners with strange religions, I mean, Irish Catholics and Polish Catholics.
Yeah.
I mean, that was his idea of weird foreigners with unspeakable religious rites.
Even some of those Italians.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, yeah.
All those immigrants that are ruining America with their Southern Europeanness. There's room for us to even go in sort of that direction towards, some of that xenophobia of the of fear of the world, fear of everything that's different. There is some root there, and how do we treat our government conspiracies? I agree that in some aspects, I sort of see that we may be playing down the 90s style agency or government out of control or conspiracy within the government. One of the ideas we've thrown around is the idea that if we create different ways of playing Delta Green in different styles, that'll be able to stand and operate in the same universe. A legitimate Delta Green, the illegitimate Delta Green, the even farther removed ex Delta Green people who are, still walking the street and have nothing to do with either the legitimate or the illegal versions of Delta Green. Even in that, we're sort of moving away from the idea that the agency is out of control, that there is a conspiracy inside the government's out of control. It's really the government that's out of control.
Yeah.
The conspiracy is the only thing that's...
It got legitimized.
The conspiracy is the only thing that's even remotely true to, a mission that matters.
Well, the kind of underlying theme that you have to address there is the big question of what are the consequences of power, you know, and
when we've all,
and of course by all, we're talking about sort of America corporately, not every single individual, but you know, when we've all kind of embraced and accepted the kind of authority that you know, that the government has accreted to itself over the last 10 years or so, what does that mean? You know, what are the implications of that, and what are the implications of that, not just in the big picture, but on the individual scale as well? And those are things that Delta Green as a game setting is primed to kind of explore through the lens of the supernatural and the Cthulhu mythos as its metaphors.
Yeah. I'm still, I'm going to say, I'm still looking forward to being able to, I'm looking forward to us, you know, creating this. I have no doubt that we're going to be able to, you know, sort of create this, create something that is going to still speak to the current zeitgeist, and perhaps even for the next few years, because I don't think we're out of this. There is kind of an interesting backslide, though, to the 90s, where, you know,
things were simpler back then.
Well, I don't mean that exactly. I mean, these enormous powers that were accrued to the executive branch in the 2000s were not a problem until there was somebody from the opposition party in charge. Right. Now they're a problem.
Now you've got a Democrat running the show, and
it's
interesting because it kind of parallels the 90s. You know, you had Clinton, exactly, you had a lot of worry about FEMA, you know, taking over, and, you know, black helicopters and all this other stuff.
I always love that about FEMA, because the classic document they always pull out on the FEMA is going to take over is the Rex 84 document, saying, oh my God, Bill Clinton's going to take over with this plan. What was a plan that was made in the early 80s by a political appointee, some guy who boosted Reagan's presidential campaign and his governor campaigns in California, who Reagan made the head of FEMA as like a booby prize, you know, for supporting him. And they left this guy alone in FEMA, and he just sort of abandoned all of FEMA's actual duties and started writing up there, produced the document Rex 84, which was how FEMA is going to save America after when the nuclear war happens and round up all the hippies and all, you know, all this other stuff. And it was, and as soon as like the Reagan administration noticed what he was doing, he was gone. I mean, you know, thanks for your contributions, good luck going back to California, tell, you know, give our regards to Bakersfield, fuck off and don't come back. I mean, he kind of got punted out of there, like that famous Secretary of the Interior James Watt, you know, where, you know, they just had to get rid of him because he was such a PR disaster. But everyone always, all the black helicopter crowd loves citing this document that, you know, that the commie liberal Bible burning gun taking, you know, internationals are going to take over. But it was designed on Reagan's watch by a guy he appointed. And again, you know, clearly it wasn't a problem until the you know, it was a good plan for saving America from the hippies. But, you know, now those liberals have filed the numbers off of it. Now we're going to round up all the God-fearing, you know, Americans and put them in the camps that were designed for hippies, mm-hmm. you know. And who needs that? What with that whole patchouli stink getting all over over your gut and your Bibles? Anyways, I'm such a bigot. That's what my problem is. There is sort of a backslide where we're getting a big upsurge in these stupid militia unit movements again in this country.
Yeah.
You know, to defend us against, you know.
Well, you have like the newest panels. Incarnation, I think, is like the Oath Keepers, where they sort of a hybrid where they are going to say, we won't follow, we're in the military, but we won't follow orders that are not constitutional or something like that.
Yeah, those guys are fascinating. The local, you know, local police agencies are sort of, they've got all kinds of memos that get circulated alerting them to, you know, what those guys are up to. And some of the memos, you know, sound really alarmist because they take them at their word, you know, when in actuality, the guys that are doing this whole Oath Keeper thing are not, or whatever they're called. I don't know if it's that or another thing, but, you know, they're, You know, they're not picking fights and ambushing ATF agents like they say they want to all the time.
Yeah, well, there have been a couple of cases.
But then again, there have been a couple killed. You know, so yeah, they always work out better in
fiction when we take them at their word.
Right.
I mean, you know, with any political movement in this country, you know, you get this. We've definitely dialed up our rhetoric to 11. But if the Muslim illegal immigrants, communist fascist president, really is an illegal alien, secret Muslim illegal alien, communist fascist president, you know, why aren't you out there shooting at the White House right now?
Mm-hmm.
You know, if that's really the world you live in. Here, take my AK-47. I'll loan it to you. You can go out there and stop this. Oh, wait, it's inconvenient. There's the game's on. You got to go to work, you know? Oh, well, then how important could it be? How critical could it really be if you're just going to stay home and gripe about it on the internet rather than actually, you know, where's your weapon stockpile? Oh, well, they're not going to tell me because clearly I'm a government plant working for the illegal alien secret Muslim communist fascist occupation government. But you know, there's the hyperbole is dialed up to 11, and it's always amusing to sort of take these people at their words, like the Dominionists. You know,
that's who I was thinking of. Yeah.
Oh yeah, the Dominionists are entertaining. You take them at their word. It's like these are guys who think that The Handmaid's Tale was a blueprint for an American utopia. You know,
I could get behind that. Yeah,
exactly. You know, we're all big stinky liberals over here at Delta Green, apparently, and yet we all own guns.
Yep.
So apparently we're not completely Mother Jones, pink alert, hairy-legged hippies.
But I think there's the subset of the Dominionists called the Quiverful movement, which is literally about having as many kids as possible in order to populate the world with, you know, Christian warriors. And it's a very small movement. There's probably only like a few thousand families that practice it, I think, within the United States. But I mean, if that's not Delta Green scenario, I don't know what is. I mean, if you can't have the Shub-Nigger Oth cult, you know.
I think we can crank out a few more extra Christian warriors if we just find a way to cut down that gestation period to say, I don't know, a month maybe, you know, then we're in business. Now we're in business, you know.
Yeah, and we can sacrifice those dirty hippies to help speed up the process.
Yeah. Exactly, perhaps. Every time I say dirty hippies, all I can think is Cartman.
dirty hippies.
You know, but yeah, that'll speed up the process as well. There's any number of ways the current crazy can be knit into the mythos. That's the marvelous thing about, you know, this playground that was created for us 70 plus years ago. Is that it? You just keep finding new ways to plug it into history, and maybe that's the thing that is, you know, the most awesome thing about the material is that, you know, you're talking about Cthulhu Invictus and Cthulhu Dark Ages, and I'm playing in a Cthulhu game set in the Wild West, and you know, we ran World War II Cthulhu games at Gen Con and World War I, and you know, this thing plugs into any epoch of human history. And it works. It still works no matter what geographical or chronological spot you pick. All right, granted, and for those who are, who aren't satisfied with this planet, certainly, you know, they can do the Dreamlands or Clark Ashton Smith's Last Continent stuff, you know, if they want a more swords and sorcery sort of thing. Hell, it's even in there's Lovecraftian elements even in, you know, Hyperborea, or Hyboria from Robert E. Howard. So
yeah, definitely.
It's not hard to graft this material to whatever the current or past issue was, you know.
Yeah. All right. Well, why don't we call it a day there? Because it's the clock's ticking along, and I actually have to leave for work at my night job alarmingly soon.
All right. Well, then let's cut Mr. Ivy loose, say that hopefully Ross will get the night mission up on RPPR soon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we can hear Shane faint like a little girl.
Yeah.
At 10,000 feet in his biplane, not a good plan. And see how that works out. With any small measure of luck, sometime next year, we're going to try and merge the night mission with that Zeppelin scenario, the last flight of the L-58, and put them out in a single book.
Oh, that would be great. Yeah, I could run it. I'd love to run the Zeppelin adventure for the RPPR group. I'd love to see how Aaron reacts to it and some of the other players, you know, Tom and Caleb and all that. So,
well, if you right now my game master is being Skyped in. If you ever want me to be Skyped in, I'll be more than happy to inflict it on your group. You know, via Skype, that would be.
Oh wow! Yeah, actually, we should do that. If you're willing to run it over Skype, I can get everyone in here. That'd be great.
It has changed since you played it, because.
When you
fell off the Zeppelin, that was very early in the development. There have been a few changes, although I will admit, guys keep falling off the Zeppelin.
Those damn dex checks. Next time I'll hang on and let my blood be fate with the
Certainly it would have given was Tom up there with you when he fell off the Zeppelin, because it certainly would have given him a big glorious sand loss to actually get to see the creature.
Someone saw me fall off. I can't remember, but there were like 8 players there. There was a very full table. Yeah. That was my first Gen Con too. That was awesome. I think the first game I played under your
And I gotta admit, I there was a look on your face like, I can't believe he killed me like that. And I'm like, I don't know what you look, this look of disbelief. I fell off the fucking Zeppelin.
I can't believe I failed that many dex checks. I
mean, there was like 3 of them down the side of the aircraft. It's just like, grab some canvas. Okay, now you're in the air.
Yeah.
Flap your arms, maybe. At this stage,
it was still a great game. All right. Well, if Shane has to go, we'll end this episode now, or this recording right now, and we'll see you guys next time.
All right. Thank you very much, guys. Thank you, Scott.
Thanks for having me on.
See ya.
All right.
Bye bye.
Oh, we had down the other day.